This is a paid commercial program and may not represent the views of Bonneville International Corporation or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions from this broadcast are solely those of the individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to the Business of Government Hour, a conversation about management with a government executive who is changing the way government does business. The Business of Government Hour is produced by the IBM Center for the Business of Government, which was created in 1998 to encourage discussion and research into new approaches to improving government effectiveness. You can find out more about the center by visiting us on the web at businessofgovernment.org. And now, the Business of Government Hour.
Welcome to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, managing editor of the Business of Government magazine. The nation stands on the verge of a new era in aviation. The national airspace system is one of the largest and safest in the world. It is also one of the busiest. In 2010, more than 700 million passengers flew on U.S. air carriers, with air traffic expected to increase by 50% in 2025, and flight delays already causing disruptions in service and loss of productivity at current capacity. A revamped system is needed to accommodate future growth. A system that will let passengers fly safely with fewer delays and less congestion, while reducing aviation's environmental impact. What is FAA's Next Generation Air Transportation System, or NextGen? How will NextGen improve the airspace system? What is FAA doing to continue to be a global leader in aviation? We will explore these questions and so much more with our very special guest, Randy Babbitt, Administrator of the Federal Aviation Administration. Welcome, Randy.
Good to be here.
Also joining our conversation from IBM is Kunal Saravanshi. Welcome, Kunal.
Glad to be here.
Randy, let's start off with at the beginning. Could you briefly give us an overview of the FAA's mission, history, and its evolution?
Sure. Well, our mission has been unchanged from day one, really, Michael. It's safety. And, you know, that's our purpose in life, is to make certain that we have the safest air transportation system. Obviously, we want to maintain the capacity or expand it, but that's our mission. The history of the FAA goes back into the 20s, the Air Mail Act, followed by the Air Commerce Act. But in 1958, they created the Independent Federal Aviation Agency. And then in 1966, they created the Department of Transportation and made it one of the modes. The Federal Aviation Administration became one of the modes of the department, and that's where we are today.
So operationally, it's such a critical mission. I'd like to get a sense of the operational footprint mm-hmm. of FAA. Mm-hmm. And what I mean by that is, could you tell us about the core lines of business that make up FAA? What's your overall budget, number of full-time employees, and the scale of operations in terms of daily air traffic activity?
Mm-hmm. It's a big operation. We have almost 49,000 employees around the nation and the world. We have four, you know, basic core functions. Clearly, you know, our aviation safety is one of them, but we also remember, we manage airports, we have air traffic control, and today we have commercial space. So NASA, as the shuttle shuts down, we have taken over that responsibility to regulate safe operations into commercial space, licensing launches and reentries.
What's the size of your budget?
Budget right now, our budget request from the president for 2012 will be a $18.7 billion budget.
And how many folks actually make the mission of FAA successful?
I like to think all of them do. It's a big operation. I mean, we divide ourselves, as I said, air traffic control. We have 15,000 air traffic controllers, very dedicated folks that handle about 100,000 operations a day.
Wow.
We transport about 2.5 million passengers a day in our airspace. The population, everybody in the United States travels twice in round numbers a year. So it's a big operation. We move a lot of airplanes, and each operation would entail hundreds of different communications. You talk to ground control, you talk to the tower, you talk to departure control, you talk to the centers en route while you navigate. So it's a very complex operation. And, of course, we certify the airplanes. You know, we inspect them. We have a lot of levels of inspection that go on to ensure the safety of the system.
So I'd like to turn to your leadership role at FAA. What are the responsibilities and duties of the administrator for the Federal Aviation Administration? And could you give us a sense of what a day or week in the life of the FAA administrator is?
Well, the one thing for certain, you'll never be bored as the FAA administrator. No, I imagine every person takes their leadership responsibilities somewhat different. We're all different individuals. But if you likened it to being the CEO, I think my job is to, number one, you know, fulfill the mission and make certain that we're getting the that every employee there, whether they're in the top leadership or the brand new hire, has an opportunity to leverage their knowledge and you know, have a sense of fulfillment. And if everybody, we're working very hard to improve the culture of the FAA employees, become more collaborative with them. We have some wonderfully bright people that work at the FAA. Well, we need to find better ways to engage them and leverage all that knowledge. And I think we're succeeding, and I think it's showing.
Randy, regarding your responsibilities and duties, what do you reckon are your top three challenges that you face in your position, and how have you addressed those challenges?
Well, that's a very good question. You know, we never take our eye off of safety, so safety is our utmost challenge. You know, we have clearly one of the challenges moving forward. We're seeing traffic grow again. We have to find ways to expand the capacity of this national air traffic system that we have. And in order to do that, we're going to have to implement a next-gen technology shift. We're going to shift from a radar-based, literally Eisenhower-era type of navigation system to the navigation system of tomorrow. The airplanes will be equipped for it. We need to have personnel that are qualified to operate in that system, along with the technology. And it's very, you know, the satellite-based is quite a change for us. But it'll bring us wonderful benefits. People say, well, it's going to cost some money to make this shift. And I like to tell them it's going to cost us more money not to make the shift.
You know, on a personal note, would you describe your career path for our listeners? How did you begin your career, and what brought you to your current leadership position?
It's a long trek when you look back at it. I have either the benefit or the curse of having done just about everything in aviation. I started down in South Florida. I learned to fly at a pretty young age. I worked as a line boy, fueled airplanes. And when I got enough time, I got a commercial pilot's license and an instructor. And I instructed while I was in college to build time. I have carried parachuters up to build time. You know, it was good money when you're 18. You know, it was a fun thing to do. Later on, I pursued my career in commercial aviation. I was a pilot for Eastern Airlines for almost 25 years. Got into a representation or leadership role in the Pilot Association. Was 8 years there as the president of the Pilots Association. And then left to go into the private sector. My airline, Eastern Airlines, had gone out of business in that stretch of time. So I started an aviation consulting company. So and we focused more on air service development in that company, and it gave me but another facet of aviation. So each of those has really added. I mean, when I look back, it was a wonderful school of a practical application. You know, it was my degree courses were varied over time.
So with that background, I want to get a sense of your from your perspective, what are the characteristics of an effective leader? And more interestingly, how has being a pilot informed your leadership style and management approach?
Well, I'm sure everybody would have their own opinions of you know, what makes you know, what attributes would be helpful to be a good leader. I think actually in piloting, if you stop and think about it, if you're a pilot of a commercial aircraft, you have a crew, and they have to be coordinated, very well coordinated. We have to exchange information properly, and if you step away from it, in my view, that's one of the attributes that any leader, whether you're heading up a division, whether you're the CEO, the COO, wherever you are in your corporation, if you're just a director of a department, it's all the same. You've got to engage the folks that work with you. I really want to use and leverage the talent that the people that are working with me have, and so in order to do that, you have to listen. You have to challenge them. They should challenge you. A lot of those attributes came from, you know, flying airplanes, really. You also learn, too, that people are different. And I give this some credibility back to my instructing days, when you would try and instruct a student, and if I told you to do something a particular way and you didn't get it, it didn't mean that there was something wrong with you. More likely, it was something wrong in the way I was trying to explain it. So maybe I need to explain it differently to you and try another approach. And I found that has been very, very helpful in my career, in negotiations, in working with other people, other companies, my own teams. Just because, you know, people say, well, geez, I don't see that. Well, it doesn't hurt to look introspectively and say, well, maybe I'm not explaining that well. Let me try this. Does it come at you better this way? And I think we could all benefit sometimes from making the assumption that maybe it's a little bit me every now and then. It's not always you.
Well, you have mentioned collaboration and the need for that, and you bring up the tools that will make you a better leader. Does the concept of leadership, has that changed in your mind because we are in an increasingly interconnected and networked world? Mm-hmm. Does the concept change because of that, do you think?
I think it has. I think we all have to be pretty aware, pretty cognizant of the fact that there's new technology and how we communicate. People have access to so much more information. And I'm becoming aware also that not only do they have access, but different ranges of people access different information. If I want to communicate with one of my grandchildren, I'm going to have to send a text message. But, you know, someone else, on the other hand, I've got an elderly aunt, and I'm going to have to call her on the telephone. She's not going to get any Twitter messages or any other things, you know. So different generations, and I think companies are becoming aware. We have different communication channels and messages. And I think we have to be careful to utilize them all, make sure that everybody is getting the message through vehicles and communications channels that they can accept.
What is aviation's next-gen strategy? We will ask Randy Babbitt, Administrator of the Federal Aviation Administration, to share with us when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. How can government cut costs and improve performance? What are federal agencies doing to be more transparent, participatory, and innovative? How is the Navy strengthening its information dominance for the 21st century? What is the U.S. Postal Service doing to reduce its carbon footprint and green its operations? And how are state and local governments doing more with less? Pick up the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine and find out. We bring you insights and interviews from government executives who are changing the way government does business. Download or order a free copy at businessofgovernment.org. Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is Randy Babbitt, Administrator of the Federal Aviation Administration. Also joining us today from IBM is Kunal Suryavanshi. Randy, the National Airspace System is one of the largest and safest in the world, but a revamped system is needed to accommodate future growth. To that end, what is the Next Generation Air Transportation System, or NextGen?
Well, the NextGen, if we take the really top view and start with that, we're going to transform our commercial, and our national airspace system from a radar-based, analog, ground-based signals for navigation into a satellite-based navigation system. And remember, we're talking about 24 million square miles of airspace. 15% of the world's traffic is in our airspace. And so this transformation is going to take, over time, almost 10 years it's going to take us to fully implement. But at the end of it, we're going to have a safer system. We're going to have a more efficient system. Our capacity will be enhanced both in the air and on the ground. Airports, remember, are valuable assets. Communities pay a lot of money to have an airport in their town. It's their factory for bringing their goods, services, and people back and forth. We want to maximize the value of that asset for them, and NextGen brings us all of those components. And one of the challenges that we have is this transformation over time, over this decade. We have to fuse the data, so we're not going to turn radar off one afternoon and turn on the satellite only. So today we have a number of areas in the country where we have satellite type of surveillance available to us. In the airplane, there's a device. It's automatic dependent surveillance broadcast. It's essentially the GPS in your car, but it talks. And so it not only knows where it is and tells you where it is, but it tells other people, air traffic control and nearby airplanes, where you are, which is a big step for us. So from a situational awareness perspective, the pilot now sees everything that the air traffic controller sees, along with a lot of other information.
So as a follow-up, what are some of the key benefits to the air transportation system from this transformation? What extent will NextGen lead to better ways of doing business?
Well, if we follow the flight, from leaving the gate, we have better ground management now with, surveillance radar available to us. Surface detection equipment on the airport allows us to better control our ground traffic. We get in the air, we are going to use more optimized profiles to take us to our destination. Instead of driving like you would on a street, making all the turns and going over these traditional navigation points, there's no reason why everyone just can't go direct at the optimum altitude. And we have a very sophisticated computer technology that will separate the traffic for us with minor corrections. I could say two aircraft going across the country, for example, headed to Los Angeles, one left from New York and another left from Boston, go the optimum route, but the one coming from Boston, would you just slow down 2 knots for me? That's all. Very minor, minor criteria. Instead of going all the way to Los Angeles and then holding for 5 minutes, wasting fuel, we can do this much more efficiently. The other thing that we get is the ability to use tailored arrivals, or what we call optimized profile descents. Everyone who flies, you're very familiar, when you start down, you level off, you hear the power come up, you go down to another lower altitude, you hear the power come up. Each one of those steps, you're going to burn a lot of fuel when you level off. And the lower you get, the more fuel the airplane burns. When you make an optimized profile descent, the simplest analogy that I can make, you go to a point where you can literally close the throttles to the airplane, and the airplane will glide all the way to the airport, burn no fuel, just very efficient. And the analogy that I make, it's the difference between walking down the steps and crossing the landings and sliding down the banister. It's a very efficient way, and we're doing this now at a number of airports up in Seattle. Alaska Airlines is using all of their arrivals coming from Alaska use the optimized profile descents, and they save 60 to 70 gallons of fuel per arrival. These are enormous amounts of fuel, and that's less carbon, it's less noise. UPS, all of their westbound arrivals into Louisville now use optimized profile descents. They literally, when you look at the noise footprints historically, they have been shrunk dramatically. It's about a 50% reduction. And that's huge. That's part of, you know, being a good operator into the area. Not only less emissions, but less noise.
Randy, a major component and backbone of NextGen is the move from, as you mentioned, the radar-based technology to satellite technology, you know, similar to the global positioning system in our cars. Would you tell us more about the new technologies, such systems as the, and you mentioned this previously, the Automatic Dependent Surveillance Broadcast, ADS-B, that play significant roles in this transition from radar-based to a satellite-based to essentially NextGen?
Mm-hmm. Well, the transformation will be today. Radar, you know, interrogates an airplane. It's the same radar, by the way, that we were using back in World War II. So it's very old technology, and it has a lot of drawbacks. Number one, the curvature of the Earth, its line of sight. So radar really only works for about 150 miles, and then the curvature of the Earth, if you're down low, we simply don't see you. Second, like a lot of radio signals, the further you get away, the less accurate the signal is. So when we're tracking an airplane on radar that's 150 miles away, where that airplane is on our scope, the error increases. So we have to put a lot more spacing between the airplanes to account for that error. For example, airplanes going across the Atlantic Ocean, we put them 50 miles apart. Aircraft that we track across the United States, we put them 20 miles apart. That's a lot of space. Imagine, you know, when I make these type of analogies, put it on the highway. So that would be the equivalent of saying every 3 minutes we put a new car on 95. Well, that's pretty slow. If we could put, you know, every 30 seconds, if we could put somebody, we could move a lot more traffic. And we can do that with the new technology because it's precise. We know exactly where the airplane is. There is no error. We know precisely where the airplane is with this satellite-based technology.
You've already touched upon this a little bit, but would you tell us a little bit more about how NextGen is being used today on the ground, in the air, and also on the approach?
Mm-hmm. Sure. Well, we get a number of things on the ground. I mentioned we have airport surface detection equipment. We've expanded that. Now, that tells us we can actually track airplanes on the ground, and at our 35 busiest airports, we have some very enhanced opportunities so that not only the next generation that we'll go to, not only will the controllers know when they try to clear an airplane onto a runway, the computer technology says, well, no, wait, you have an airplane crossing up ahead. You can't clear this one for takeoff yet. So even though it's a tool, it's an added safety tool for the controllers. We also can see precisely where the traffic is on the ground. We've used this technology to really improve the flow of traffic. Remember, in bad weather, the controllers can't necessarily see the airplanes. Atlanta Tower, the tower cab is 300 feet in the air. Well, if the ceiling is 200 feet, every controller is sitting 100 feet into the clouds, so they can't see. So we need this type of surface detection equipment to help them flow the traffic on the ground and bad weather conditions or, you know, in blind spots and so forth. For arrivals and departures today, under the analog arrival processes, if we were to shoot an approach, have a vertical and horizontal guidance to a runway, it is going to be a straight line on a signal. Okay, we have one line coming out to give us horizontal whether we're left or right of course. We have another beam that comes out and tells us that we're on the proper approach slope. So we have these two beams. And by definition, they're straight lines. Well, when we come into National Airport, we stay over the river. Well, that's not a straight line. So what we do with GPS signals and this very refined signal, we can put a series of points in space and create an approach that curves. If we want to know where we're actually using this today, Alaska Airlines goes in and out of Juneau. 5,000-foot mountains on either side, they come down a river, and they make a 90-degree turn, and they land at the Juneau Airport. And it's a beautiful procedure. I've done it myself on the jump seat, and I've done it in a simulator. It's a precision approach. Last year, Alaska Airlines estimated that 729 times using conventional procedures, they would not have gotten into Juneau. Those flights would have diverted somewhere else. So this technology enabled them to come in safely, 729 times that they didn't divert. That's a good example of how we use it to avoid terrain and provide precision approaches into mountainous areas in bad weather. But it has other, I think, very helpful usage. When we go into Seattle today, Alaska Airlines, again, uses a one of these precision-type approaches that's curved, and they stay over the water and avoid a residential area so they don't fly over the homes. It's a noise-compliant and make some good neighbors up there. So a lot of uses for this, all of it beneficial.
Recently, FAA has shifted its focus from the longer term, that is beyond 2018, and emphasized improvements that can be implemented in the near term and midterm. That's the period between 2010 and 2018. The shift responds in part to concerns expressed by stakeholders and Congress. What lessons have been learned from NextGen's phased-in implementation that continues to inform your efforts? And will you be able to carry out your near-term and midterm transformation milestones, given the budget realities of today?
If I just touch on the budget realities of today, I mean, the president's budget will enable us to do the things that we're proposing to do. And I think it's very important for us, particularly in this area, that the things we propose to do are truly investments that enhance our assets, our airports, and our ability to move our people around. It's our belief that it'd be far more expensive not to do some of these things than it would be to do them. So the cost, the burden, for example, in 2018, we propose our forecast, supported by other people, indicate that we will have saved 1.5 billion gallons of aviation fuel, kerosene, by the implementation, the schedule that we're on, of next-gen technology. Now, 1.5 billion gallons of fuel at $3 a gallon. And this is an ongoing. Every year after, we're looking at about 1 billion gallons of fuel saved. That's an enormous amount of carbon emissions that didn't happen. It's less noise. It's money, to say nothing of the increased productivity of the shorter routes and so forth. But going back to your core question, when we laid out a linear schedule, these are the things that we would implement over time. I don't think that, and I'm not being critical of anybody, but I don't think we paid enough attention, and I think we're paying better attention today, to, you could do them 1 through 10, but we could use 8 tonight. So why don't we do 8 now? Can we do it? Good example, in the Gulf of Mexico, we were laying out our schedule of the array of antennas for these receivers across the nation. And it doesn't really make any difference. I mean, there's no equipment to use anyway, and so you get all the antennas out there. But by giving the helicopters that fly into the Gulf the equipment, or equipping them, and putting the antenna array out there ahead of schedule, today we have 250,000 square miles of positively controlled airspace that you can't use radar in. And it's not a small amount of traffic. Those helicopters take 10,000 people a day on and off oil rigs. There's 3,800 rigs in the Gulf. And, you know, they work long schedules, so the folks that work on those rigs, they go out for 7 days and they come home. They're constantly in rotation, 10,000 a day. So we're safely transporting by simply moving the delivery of the array of the antennas and the equipment into a different time slot. We take benefit today. So those are the types of things, focusing on our metroplexes and using the things that the carriers say, you know, we're going to get this eventually, but why don't you put it in now and we can use it? So Louisville, we're using ADS-B. In Philadelphia, we have some experiments. We've got a number of areas where we're using this technology. Down in Florida, one of the flight schools down there has all of their aircraft equipped with this ADS-B technology so that in the flight training, they can all see each other. And it's a partnership that we have. We get a lot of information, and they get good value.
Randy, I'd like to turn towards capacity and being the backbone of air travel. Would you give us an overview of some of the strides you've made, some initiatives around adding capacity to the current aviation system? And more particularly, what are some of the near-term initiatives that you've pursued, and how are you getting state and local governments involved in these initiatives?
Well, in terms of capacity, we have to, obviously the capacity, the demand on the system grows. And so we want our capacity to keep up with it. So some of the things that we're doing, we built in the last half a dozen years or so, we put 16 new runways. That doesn't sound like much, but 16 new runways in the country, when you think about how often a runway is used, that allows up to 2 million additional operations. So, 2 miles of concrete in a runway, it brings you a lot of benefit, moves a lot of people. We've done other capacity enhancements that, are helping our system by using some of the next-gen technology. We tended in the past to treat airspace in the metropolitan areas as one mass of airspace. Let me use Chicago as a general example. You have two airports up there. One is O'Hare, one is Midway. Their proximity makes them one big piece of airspace. So if O'Hare is at capacity and one more airplane comes in to Midway, even though Midway has only got 10 airplanes lined up, they're going to be delayed because of O'Hare today or yesterday. But by using precise navigation, we can decouple those airports. And so Midway becomes undependent, unimpeded by the traffic at O'Hare. So those are the types of, think of New York metropolitan area. We have LaGuardia, we have Newark, we have Kennedy Airport, we have Teterboro, just right in one cluster. So when that airspace gets congested, Kennedy sneezes, Teterboro gets a cold. We can decouple those. There are times when we have to restrain some of those airports because of international arrivals and things like that. Here's an airport that's 20 miles away and is suffering because of what's going on across the river. This technology will allow us to decouple and operate each of those airports efficiently.
So how do the state and local governments get involved in these near-term type of capacity-building exercises?
Well, the way our system works, Michael, we look at every airport's contribution to the national airspace system. So if someone says, we have an airport, we'd like to add an additional 10,000-foot runway, we would take that into consideration and say, you only have 12 airplanes landing a day. I don't know that you really are going to fit the need. But on the other hand, some airports, by adding a 2,000-foot extension, will allow bigger aircraft, really unburden another airport or something. We work with these. Remember that the FAA doesn't own any airports. We regulate them. We do a lot of things with them, but we don't own them and we don't operate them. So the operators will come to us and say, here's a plan. We think it'll enhance the capacity. We think it improves the safety. We look at that, and then we have some discretionary fundings, our Airport Improvement Fund, which comes from user fees put on the ticket prices. That's how we enhance our airports today. And so we work with the communities to help them understand, where the better benefits come from and help them sometimes with funding.
You've done a wonderful job of explaining NextGen and the technology and innovation that underlies the whole vision that is NextGen. But I want to talk about how are you sort of testing the technology, and what role does the next-gen integration and evaluation capability platform factor into your efforts?
Well, it's a fascinating platform, and it's a very important tool that we can, in fact, simulate and actually put into practice. We have laboratories where we take controllers using the new technology in simulated conditions to, load up traffic and then see what the next-gen technology will do. And then we can measure and gauge the performance. That's one stage. Then you actually go out and test it in a limited area in the field, which is the second phase. Then you take it system-wide. But you start with rigorous testing in a laboratory. We can take you today into laboratories and show you, as if it were 2014 right now, I can show you what air traffic looks like using all the technology that we believe will be deployed in 2014. I can take you two doors down to a laboratory where it's 2018. And in 2018, we've got data link communications. Let me give you an example. Today, if you both were pilots going into the New York area, and all of a sudden it's summertime, big thunderstorm comes up, so I, as your controller, I have to pick a route for you to take you around this weather. So I call you up, I design a couple of new airways to take you around. I read you a clearance. You read it back to me. You don't like yours, though, so you don't like that. You say, well, I read it back, but I don't want to do that. I want to go further west. So, okay, so I get you another one. I read it to you. You read it back to me. This takes time. Datalink, I see where the weather is. I have forecasting tools. I can see where the weather's moving. I design a route that's optimum for you. I push a button. It sends a data link to you, like an email message. It goes right into your flight management computer and says, in order to avoid this weather, do you accept it or not? Yes or no? There's no data entry. There's no misunderstanding. There's no voice communication problems. It goes right into your flight computer. If you don't like it, you can reject it. Or you can, worst case, you can always pick up the microphone and say, look, I want to go further west. I think this weather is too rough. I don't want to fly through it. And I've only given you the case of two. There's 40 airplanes.
Yeah.
40 voice communications would be necessary, and sometimes people read back, they make an error in the read back, I have to catch that, correct it. So this is going to be a huge improvement in safety and efficiency for us.
How is FAA pushing the bar higher on safety? We will ask Randy Babbitt, Administrator of the Federal Aviation Administration, to share with us when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. How can government cut costs and improve performance? How are disruptive innovations saving lives on the battlefield and expanding our presence in space? What is the U.S. Navy doing to strengthen its information dominance for the 21st century? What are federal agencies doing to be more transparent, participatory, and innovative? And how are federal agencies leveraging technology to improve mission effectiveness? Pick up the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine and find out. The Fall-Winter 2010 edition of the Business of Government magazine provides insights from those who lead. Hear from Richard Spires, leading Homeland Security's technology effort, Dr. Bobby Braun, advancing NASA's space technology program, Vice Admiral Jack Dorsett, strengthening the U.S. Navy's information dominance, and Cass Holloway, ensuring the New York City water system is viable for the next 100 years. All of this and so much more in the Fall-Winter 2010 edition of the Business of Government magazine. Download or order a free copy at businessofgovernment.org and find out how the business of government is not business as usual. Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is Randy Babbitt, Administrator of the Federal Aviation Administration. Also joining us today from IBM is Kunal Suryavanshi. Randy, safety, as you've pointed out, is at the core of FAA's mission, and its commitment at pushing the bar higher in developing new safety strategies is obvious. Would you elaborate on some safety initiatives such as safety management system or the call to action? And how are you combating corporate inertia when times are so good?
Well, I think safety is one of those areas where you never stop. I mean, you just have to keep trying to raise the bar at all times. And that's one of the things that we work toward. I mean, complacency is no place in aviation. This is a business where, you know, one accident is one too many. And we have certainly changed the strategies. You know, we had a serious accident a few years ago. That accident showed us some areas we had a lot of room to improve in. We needed clearly to make a transformation in some technological changes we could do in training and how we could train better. It also indicated that we could certainly do a better job of teaching our pilots the importance of being professionals. We clearly needed to understand fatigue and the management of fatigue better. And some of this fell right on the shoulders of the carriers. And so we had a call to action. Secretary LaHood and I went out together. We had 10 different city road shows. We brought pilots together from all over the country, had a call to action, and said, it's our business. We need to fix it. And we need to talk about these things. You need to do a number of these things in data collection, professionalism, how you mentor, how we transfer experience from the older pilots to the younger ones. All of these things came in. How you scrutinize who you hire was an issue. And so we've done that, you know, how pilot qualifications, we've got a new rule that's in the making for flight and duty rest rules. We've had a great reaction from the industry today. Every regional carrier now participates in these voluntarily reporting programs. We have transitioned, you know, we have not had an accident in this country that killed a passenger in 2 years. That's a remarkable safety record. But it's one that we can't just be happy and complacent that that's what happened. We need to keep focus. I remind people that the miracle in the Hudson was not a miracle. The airplane landed in the Hudson because it had highly qualified air traffic controllers. It had a highly qualified crew. The airplane was built to withstand that landing. It had equipment that got everybody out of it. There was no miracle involved. It was the process and the product of a lot of safety enhancements that have taken place over a decade. So, you know, that's where the safety paid off. When we look at the safety enhancements that we're making, it's been cooperation in the industry and reliance on data. We can't investigate accidents anymore because we don't have too many, but we don't want any. So we have to rely more today on data, and we rely on data streamed from the aircraft electronically. We also have programs where you can voluntarily report without fear of reprisal when something happens and it's a mistake. Don't just be silent about it. I'll give you immunity. Just tell me what happened so that the next person doesn't make the same mistake. That's a huge change in our culture, but it's one worthy of pursuing.
And I'd like to pursue the data aspects. And in particular, what is FAA doing to promote and expand safety information sharing efforts? And more particularly, how is analytics contributing to improving air safety?
Very good questions, Michael. The data has come a long ways. First, there was some reluctance. Everyone in the early days, pilots in particular, would say, wait a minute, this is inviting Big Brother to watch everything I do, isn't it? But the pilots very quickly learned that the information in mass coming off of the airplanes could show trends. Could show operational trends, it could show engine trends, mechanical. All of these things are data. It's all information. And if analyzed properly, we say, whoa, you know, we need to change procedure here. We need to make an adjustment because this data is showing us that there's a trend that we don't like. We need to maybe instruct pilots better about this or show mechanics this data so they can do something operationally different. So that was the first level. The second level is, so now that this carrier in particular, on a type of airplane, for example, would have this data, why should they be the sole recipient of it? Why shouldn't they share? If they're seeing a trend, why shouldn't they share that with others, other airlines that operate the same equipment? So clearly there's some issues, competitive issues come forward. But we can redact the data and put it into a database that everyone can see. And so now we have a much broader base, and the more information and the more analytics we put behind it, the better we are equipped to bring safety changes, to provide information to people, and so forth. So it's been a long trek, and we've got more to go. We have the ability today. We saw the tragedy in Air France out. Should we be developing the ability to stream data off the airplanes when they're out of range like that? And the answer is yes. We have the technology. We can do it to satellites. We do it today. But we should do a better job of that, and that's probably our next frontier.
Talking of next frontiers, I have a question about space transportation. As the NASA Space Shuttle program winds down, the nation will increasingly rely on the commercial sector to take over orbital flights. Commercial space travel presents an entirely new set of challenges in terms of safety and regulation. What are some of the key challenges in this area? And would you elaborate on the FAA-NASA partnership that laid the foundation for building the nation's future space transportation capability?
Well, you're absolutely right. This transformation is well underway, and we now have the responsibility for licensing both the launches and the reentries. And our cooperation and our collaborative arrangement with NASA has been a huge benefit. I think we actually have a little bit of a tailwind, an advantage, if you would, in that Charlie Bolden, who is the NASA administrator, and I are personal friends. He's a terrific guy. They made a wonderful choice there, I believe. And we've had a great relationship. For example, when they began to shut down some of their facilities, we needed a lot of new experts, people who had space-based experience in both the regulations and the safety parameters and so forth. And so we arranged to have job fairs. So, we brought them over, made them FAA employees. Facilities were exchanged very simply, very efficient transfer. And a lot of that was, I think, due to the fact that we knew each other and said, look, we want this to be a positive outcome. Let's work together and, cooperate on this transfer. We also, I think one of the things that we're trying to do is inspire. We still have a little bit of an incentive, if you would. We've been given that authority by Congress to promote space. And so we've got some thoughts about encouraging people to develop very low-cost, low-Earth orbit vehicles, reusable. We've actually are asking for money to provide a prize, you know, first person to do this. We will help you fund some of that research retroactively if you do a good job and so forth. Very exciting times for us. You know, there's it's a huge new frontier, if you would, and great opportunity.
You know, when we think about how much it costs to run the nation's air transportation system, we tend to think first about technology. But capital assets such as equipment and concrete, and you touched upon that previously, used to build, say, the base of a tower or lay a runway, the underlying structure of the system is just as critical. What is the FAA doing to track money spent on capitalization and ensure that the taxpayers are getting the best value for the dollar? And would you outline the things you're doing to improve financial management at the FAA?
Well, you know, I take that very seriously. It's a huge responsibility. We put billions of dollars into our nation's infrastructure, that infrastructure as it pertains to aviation. And so we take that very seriously. We have revamped our acquisitions process. We have a very robust system today. We do a cost-benefit analysis of everything that we bring on board. Will it, in fact, benefit? We also, some of the things that we do, and we have to spend a little time explaining sometimes, that we did this because it's safer. And it's not so much the cost of doing it, so what's the benefit? Well, what would be the cost if we didn't do it in safety? And so sometimes that's a discussion that we have to have with people that are looking at it on a cold, hard numbers basis. But for much of what we do, we certainly justify it on a cost-benefit type of understanding. Secondly, technology is different today. It's not like when you build a home and you take a few draws. You say, okay, well, I'm going to build a house for $100,000. Here's $20,000. When the foundation is finished, we'll give you the next $20,000. And you go out and you look at the building site. That's fine. That's you know, analog type of project management. Today, we have very, very complicated 6, 8, 10-year technical programs that are being developed. And it takes a different type of technical oversight. It takes a different type of project management. So is the software moving at the pace we want? Is it being tested properly? Are we paying? Are we getting what we're paying for? And that's a responsibility we have to Congress and to the taxpayers of this country to make sure that the answers to those are yes. Yes. So we have designed a number of our procedures, actually restructuring much of the FAA. I remind people that it was literally designed the lines of business in the way we were structured back in the 50s. And it's not the 50s anymore. It's a new world. This is, you know, the technology and how we interrelate and our trying to be much more cross-business line aware, using, you know, more, I don't want to use some of the buzzwords, but, you know, matrix-type functions where we take the best. A lot of times someone, you know, in air safety, for example, might have some thoughts about an acquisition, and why aren't we capturing that? So I'm trying to make those vehicles transparent and open, you know, in communication so that we can leverage the knowledge that we have from everyone.
Randy, would you tell us more about the FAA's efforts to promote sustainability and reduce aviation's environmental impacts? How does the Continuous Lower Energy Emissions and Noise Program, also referred to as the CLEAN Program, factor into this effort? And what other programs are being pursued in this area?
Well, that CLEAN Program is a great example of collaboration, you know, with our partners in the industry. It's a team not only within the FAA. We bring science into this, but we bring partners from the industry. We have aircraft manufacturers, engine manufacturers, all working together. And I think they understand, we all understand, that noisy, smoky airplanes coming in and out of your cities are not desirable. They don't, you know, nobody's interested in having more of those. We have taken, just to give an example, if you go back into the 70s and we use a 65 decibel level, you know, where that footprint is around an airport, 7 million people in this country were subjected to 65 or greater decibel levels. Today, that number is 400,000. And we'd like it shrunk more. And programs like CLEAN help us. So, you know, whether it's Pratt Whitney, Boeing, GE, Rolls-Royce, they're all working together with us to design these use less energy, lower emissions, less noise. All of that makes them better partners, and it makes them better citizens coming in and out of your airports. So, you know, that's just one component. Now, NextGen itself, by using more efficient direct routes, shorter times, less fuel. We talked about the arrivals, the departures, getting an airplane up and out of an area quickly. We can do with the same navigational procedures and accuracy. So get you up and away so you don't make as much noise leaving, you don't make as much noise arriving, you burn less fuel. It's a win-win-win.
Randy, I'd like to turn towards the global stewardship the global leader that FAA is in aviation. And I'd like to get under your purview, how are you expanding this perception and actually making a difference globally?
You know, it's interesting. One of the things that I sort of was, I shouldn't say I was surprised, but I was very impressed with at the FAA was early in my career. I mean, I hadn't been involved 6 or 8 weeks, and I began to get calls from people from other countries, and they would say, we're thinking about doing something. How does the FAA do it? We're thinking about implementing a procedure. We're adopting a new rule. We're thinking of redesigning the way our inspector. But the end of the sentence was always, how does the FAA do it? And I realized the great esteem that we're respected around the world. I mean, we literally, I don't want to sound like I'm bragging, but I mean, our experience here, the technologies that we have deployed, and you know, our accident rate is the most, you know, it's the lowest in the world. I mean, we run the biggest system in the world, and I mean, it clearly it's not the gold standard, it's the platinum standard. And so to that end, it benefits us all to have a safer world. And so we're not shy about exporting the knowledge we have, and we're willing partners too. So when countries who develop aviation programs, they want to come to us and bring their middle management in, we don't object at all to helping train them, to help showing them the technology we're deploying. And it's a beneficial partnership. And by the way, you know, the benefit that comes out of that sometimes, as good as we are, every now and then somebody develops some technology elsewhere and they show it to us and we're happy to adopt with them. So it's a great sharing opportunity for us. It's a great opportunity to enhance air travel and its safety around the world by doing this, because it shouldn't be lost on any of us that Americans travel not just on U.S. airplanes. So if we're interested in our citizens having safe travel, we should be striving to make sure everyone has the same level of standards and the same level of safety that we have.
The FAA received $1.3 billion in Recovery Act funds. Would you tell us about the areas that these funds were targeted for? Mm-hmm. And give us an example of some of the projects that happened and how you tracked and reported on the progress of these projects.
Well, the Recovery Act, remember, it had some parameters of its own. So there was a little bit of difference given that we'd had an extra $1 billion that we'd put into our airport improvement program. We couldn't necessarily follow the exact footprint or steps because of Recovery Act, some obligations to make sure that we had uniformly distributed around the countries and so forth in different states. But we had a wonderful advantage, and that is that people, our projects are very long-term projects. When someone proposes to build a new tower, when someone proposes to add a runway or a taxiway or a freight apron or something to enhance the capacity of the airport, it's a longer process. It has to go through environmental impact studies and so forth. So we have these in a queue. So we were able to say, well, we can just push the queue up consistent with the Recovery Act requirements. And so we were able to deploy our money. I think we held a record for getting our money out the door. I mean, literally putting people to work, getting the jobs, getting the projects underway, enhancing safety, because they were in the queue. And all we had to do was make certain that the queue of you know, request was compatible with the requirements of the Recovery Act. Now, we have also to our advantage, we didn't have to develop any new acquisition or tracking strategy. We have built in, we have a highly monitored system that we're routinely reviewed by the GAO. The Office of Inspector General looks at our work quite often, and I'm really pleased. I mean, we're quite open to the criticism. If someone says, hey, you could have done a better job, good, then we will. Next time, we will. But we really receive pretty glowing reviews, and we're highly, you know, certainly Congress wants to pay attention where you spend the money, and we had several organizations look at us, and so I was very happy that our tracking was consistent. We were on time. You know, we had one kind of interesting, because the state that the economy was in, a number of the bids we had came in below where we thought they would. And so we actually were able to do more projects because people were pretty aggressively going after these bids. And so we were able to use leverage about $150 to $200 million of extra projects that we were able to do because of low bidding. And so we went back for a second round and granted those too. It was really, we did a lot of good work around the country, replaced some of our infrastructure, aging facilities, and, you know, did some of the very important things to increase or improve safety at airports.
What does the future hold for the Federal Aviation Administration? We will ask FAA Administrator Randy Babbitt to share with us when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. From contaminated peanut butter to spinach, our food safety net has shown signs of fraying, with tainted products slipping through to retail shelves, causing human harm and economic ruin. Pick up the latest Center report on food safety and find out how critical private-public partnerships are enhancing the current food safety system in America. You can order or download a free copy of this and all of our reports at businessofgovernment.org. Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is Randy Babbitt, Administrator of the Federal Aviation Administration. Also joining us today from IBM is Kunal Suryavanshi. Randy, I talked to many of my guests about the use of collaboration and partnerships among agencies in the private sector to achieve mission results. How are you leveraging partnerships to improve operations and outcomes, and how do you envision these partnerships changing over time?
Well, we actually have a pretty good base of partnerships that we have today. For example, we have a CAS program, which is a commercial aviation safety team, where we bring together folks from all over the industry, people who build airplanes, engines, operate, pilots, everybody, and they bring us safety improvements, and we're part of that team. But together, we collaborate on things that they're seeing as practitioners in the industry. Very, very valuable for us. I mentioned to you some of the data reporting, the idea that we have. And this takes a leap of faith where pilots, mechanics, dispatchers, flight attendants, anybody working in the industry can file reports and say, you know, I just saw something that wasn't healthy and I think we ought to make, an improvement here. That's the shift. If people ask, you know, well, why is that so important? Well, in the old days, you'd have one safety inspector in a factory looking at, you know, maybe 1,000 people working there. By using this system, we have 1,000 inspectors. Anybody can point out a safety deficiency, and it's a big difference. They see a lot of things that the inspector might not see. So, you know, that's an example. The biggest thing, though, and one of the changes that we've made is internal collaboration with our own employees. So we've got our air traffic controllers in a huge step forward have embraced a safety reporting program, and we have, in return, we bring them now all of our deployments of new technology. We bring working teams of, you know, real live controllers. They're the folks that do this every day. And so it's not something that's being handed down on tablets to them. It's something that they help us build the process and the procedure. And they're part of it. They have ownership of it. And they bring us great information. And I think they're very proud of their contribution. And it overall, the change in the morale and the culture has just, it's been wonderful. So I'm very encouraged by that. So we really try and multiply everywhere we go now. We try to get this input, engage employees. We have one of the things we've done, we have an idea hub. So any employee can come in and say, you know what, I mean, some of them are cute. We now have stickers all over our big buildings. Walk one, ride two. That's for elevators, you know, energy. So better for you, better for the environment. So if you're only going to go one floor, walk. But that was an employee suggestion. So we do a lot of things like that. And the employees get engaged. And it's part of their operation. So everywhere we can, we try to involve and collaborate with our partners.
Randy, you've spoken very passionately about NextGen in this interview. The shift to NextGen's new technology will require staff with new expertise and competencies, as its new technology will demand new skill sets from the aviation workforce. To that end, would you tell us more about your efforts to have the right people with the right skills in place through recruiting, retention, and succession planning? How do you prepare the next generation aviation workforce for a national airspace system that is still taking shape?
Well, it's a challenge, no question. And we're addressing that challenge in a sort of a multifaceted way, if you would. Number one, we have 48,000 plus employees. They're bright people. We hired them, but we hired them for a skill set of, in some cases, 30 years ago. Mm-hmm. So we need to, for the employees that we have, give them the opportunity, give them, you know, the availability of training and courses and so forth to help them transition. Secondly, when we look forward, we're completely revamping what we do in human resources and our, you know, people department, if you would, so that when we look for new people, we're going to be looking for a different set of skills The person we hire tomorrow isn't the same necessary set of skills that we were looking for 10 years ago. We want to, you know, be flexible so that, you know, we can bring these people in. So it's a combination of making certain that the people are here, that work here, and are good, loyal employees to the FAA have the opportunity to learn.